Good morning. It is 6 minutes after 9 o'clock, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm here today filling in for Kathleen Dunn. Colony collapse disorder, or CCD, has been killing bees on a massive scale for the past several years. But despite the sheer number of dead bees, the questions about what is behind CCD are many, and they are varied. CCD has been blamed in all sorts of things, whether it's pesticides, monoculture agriculture, even cell phones or space aliens. And the fear is that if CCD is not addressed, and addressed soon, the world's food supply and our environment could be at risk. This hour, an update on CCD. There is some progress, but there is an awful lot of work left to do. We'll be talking with two guests this hour. Diana Cox Foster is with us. She is a professor of entomology at Pennsylvania State University and the co-director of the Colony Collapse Disorder Team. And good morning, Diana Cox Foster.
Good morning, Gene. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, it's good to have you along. And also joining us, Dennis Van Engelsdorp. He is the acting state apiarist. I'm going to ask him how to pronounce that, for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And together, the two co-wrote an article, Solving the Mystery of the Vanishing Bees, published in the March 31st edition of Scientific American. And Dennis Van Engelsdorp, good morning. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Great. And could you pronounce, is it apiarist?
Sure. An apiarist.
Apiarist. Okay.
Yes.
I looked at the dictionary. I said it out loud many, many times. An apiarist is it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get started here with a little bit of history about colony collapse disorder. And I'm not sure who would like to start on this. Perhaps let's start with you, Diana Cox Foster. This has been around for a couple of years. There's been a lot of reports of it in the media. Talk about, in your estimation, how it began, where it might have begun, and where we are now.
I think we still don't really understand completely when and where it began. There's reports from the beekeepers themselves that there were some unexplained die-offs that had the mysterious symptoms that we see with CCD going back as early as 2004 here in the U.S. It was the fall of 2006 that myself and Dennis and several other people got panicked calls from Dave Hackenberg about what he had just seen with bees that he had taken down into Florida that looked like they were healthy and shouldn't have had problems otherwise. Dennis would be able to tell you more about what he's found
sure.
in surveys and looking at bees across the nation.
And I want to bring Dave Hackenberg's story into this for a second, because I'm not sure everybody realizes that there are people like Dave Hackenberg who keep bees and then put them on trucks and take them around the country to pollinate crops, and that this is a pretty large industry. It's not just, you know, bees living out in the woods somewhere coming out and pollinating the corn at night. But Dennis Van Engelsdorp, perhaps you could bring us up to speed on Dave's story and some of the reports that you started to hear.
Well, and I think you hit on a very important point there, and that what we have in the country is that half of the colonies in the country are managed by about 900 beekeepers, and these beekeepers are migratory beekeepers. And so they're the last nomadic farmers in America, and they're not in the business for honey, but in the business of moving hives around to pollinate crops. And Dave Hackenberg is perhaps one of the larger beekeepers in Pennsylvania, but he pollinates crops in California, in Florida, in Maine, in New Jersey, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania. So he moves around a lot. And our big concern with these die-offs is not that the bees are going to go extinct, but that these beekeepers are going to go bankrupt. And who replaces these beekeepers because of the special skill set they have? Dave Hackenberg, as Diana said, was a commercial beekeeper who in 2006, the fall of 2006, had what he called were fantastic hives. And he moved these hives down to Florida, as he does every year, in October. And a month later, he found that 2,000 of his 3,000 colonies were completely empty. It was like a ghost town, he describes it. And so that's when we got involved and started this investigation.
So when go ahead.
So it's important to also put this in context. This sort of loss has happened sporadically over time. We have some records from the 1800s where this may have happened. But it's really critical right now because we've been losing bees for known reasons for a long time. So in the 1980s, these mites were introduced into the country, and they have wiped out 50% of the colonies. And so already we're talking about really low populations of bees, and we're sort of right at that threshold if we lose too many more bees, we won't have enough bees to pollinate the crops.
And I'd like to remind listeners that you'll have the opportunity to call in. If you'd like to, here's our toll-free number, 800-642-1234. You can also get us by email, and that address is talk@wpr.org. This hour, we're talking about colony collapse disorder among bees with our guests, Dennis Van Engelsdorp and Diana Cox Foster, two people who co-wrote an article, Solving the Mystery of the Vanishing Bees. It was published in the March 31st edition of Scientific American. And we are catching up this hour on colony collapse disorder, what has happened up to this point, and perhaps where we go now. Now, Dennis Van Engelsdorp, you're talking about bees already being at sort of a low population, and this sort of adding to that. When colony collapse disorder first came into the news a couple of years ago, there were all sorts of dire predictions about what would happen to the nation, the world's food supply, if the bee population was affected. Are those fears real, or are they just part of media hype?
Well, I think that it's important to realize that without bees, we won't starve. I mean, one in every three bites of food we eat is the result of, or indirect or direct result of, honeybee pollination. But that means two-thirds of our diet comes from other sources, like corn doesn't need pollination, bee pollination, nor does rice, nor does potatoes. But if we want that variety in our diet, if we want to produce apples in this country, if we want to produce blueberries in this country, almonds, we need bees to do that. So I think that it's not as if we're going to starve or we're at the brink of some, you know, major famine, but I do think that if we want to continue to have that variety and excitement in our diet, we need to have bees. And I think that we're concerned that these large commercial beekeepers are going to go out of business if they continue to lose 50% or more of their colonies every year for 3 years in a row. I don't know how they stay in business. And if they go out of business, it's not like you can replace them very easily. Because to be a commercial beekeeper, you have to be willing to move your family up and down the coast. You have to be a truck driver, you have to be a businessman, you have to be a carpenter, a mechanic, a beekeeper. And that's a skill set that's just not easily replaced.
And it's a skill set I think a lot of people don't know about. I have to say, I saw a video on this some years ago called Taking the Bees for a Ride, and it was a short film about a migrant farmer, as you say, with his semi-truck and his hives full of bees, going around the country, and it followed him throughout part of a season. And I have to say, it exposed a side of life that I had never even considered for one moment.
Well, and it's true. I mean, I think honeybees and that role they play for that 2 weeks that a bloom is out, that apple blooms are in flower, for instance, that we need bees there just for those 2 weeks, and we need to get them out because there's not enough food for them to survive and they might start spraying pesticides, is something that a lot of people aren't aware of. But it's critical. We often joke in our circles that, you know, beekeeping is the ugly stepsister in the agricultural world, but it's really the keystone species. It's what holds our fruit and vegetable production together.
Now, Diana Cox Foster, yeah, I wanted to bring you back into the conversation. You had something to add.
Yes. So I think it's critical to point out that this migratory beekeeping is not something that's brand new. It's actually been going on since the 1930s, and a part of it's because of the shift that we've had in going from small farms into having much larger acreages and removing a lot of people having their own bees on their farms, or removing the farms away from having other pollinators available. And as Dennis said, that there's many different crops that are dependent, but some things that people may not realize, it's also things like onions and broccoli and carrots that also depend on bees for pollination, not to actually get what we eat, but to grow the seed that will grow the next year's crop. So without the bees, we'd be missing many things that would give us essential vitamins and nutrients. We'd have to figure out how to make those other ways.
Either figure out how to make them other ways or be prepared to pay a lot more for them.
Right. And as Dennis contributed in the article, you know, having the type of variety in our diet that we have that we consider to be the basis of the food pyramid, per se, that we'd have to all be kings or be independently wealthy to continue to eat that way.
Now, Diana Cox Foster, you're also listed here as the co-director of what is called the Colony Collapse Disorder Team. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the work of that organization, of that team. It sounds like you were called into action shortly after this was identified. How do you get started on something that is so mysterious and yet sort of so all-encompassing?
So before Colony Collapse Disorder came about, I was actually working on diseases in honeybees and looking at their interactions with these parasitic mites that Dennis described before, and trying to figure out why bees were dying because of the mite influence on them as well. And so as Dave Hackenberg had his symptoms, many of us who he called realized the severity of the problem and what this might mean. And it was that group that came together, and Dennis is one of those key people. Jeff Pettis, who's down at Beltsville, and many of his other colleagues, Judy Chen and Jay Evans, Dave Tarpey, who's at North Carolina State University, Jerry Hayes, who's in Florida, and then we have several other people here at Penn State that happen to be working on bees, Marianne Frazier, Jim Frazier, Chris Mullen, Nancy Ostege, and then Christina Grosinger. We all came together and began to discuss what could be underlying this, and as things grew, many other people joined us to begin to look at this. So it was more of a nomination to become the co-director than a selection, I guess, by any independent group. But Jeff Pettis and I were the original leaders of the group.
So the group got together, and then meanwhile, Dave Hackenberg's report was one, but other reports started coming in from around the country.
Right, and I think we need to point out how essential Dave was in the whole process. Many of these beekeepers had been having problems of the same sort, but they had been thinking that they were doing something wrong, that was that they were the ones to blame. And so Dave encouraged other people to come forward and actually put his neck on the line, because some people originally thought it was just bad beekeeping or bad practice, and I think he's now convinced everyone, possibly because many of them have also had the same problem, but it enabled us to begin to learn just how extensive this was, that there were people having this that had no apparent connection with each other and that were widely distributed across the U.S.
On a related note, I've got an email here from Evan, who writes from New Auburn. Your guests mentioned that the large commercial beekeepers have been dramatically affected by CCD, but Evan asks, what about small or organic beekeepers, and could the fact that bees are not naturally a migratory species be part of the cause behind CCD? And I'm not sure who would like to take that. Dennis, maybe we could start with you.
Well, I think that one of the things that we've been doing with the Apiary Inspectors of America and the USDA is doing a national survey for the last two winters, and we're in the final stages of this winter's survey, where we try to quantify how many colonies lost. And there we targeted small beekeepers and middle-sized beekeepers and large beekeepers. And by and large, everyone on average is losing the same number of hives. But if you have 10 hives and you lose 50%, you know, that hurts you because these are your hobby and it's traumatic. But if you have 5,000 colonies and you lose 2,500 bees, that's still the same percentage, but it's much more dramatic and it has much more important ramifications agriculturally. As to the question about organic beekeeping, we have heard reports of some organic beekeepers, and there's a lot of questions about, well, what is an organic beekeeper? Like, what areas can we really say are organic unless you're living in the jungle?
Mm-hmm.
But there are people who haven't used pesticides and are relatively pesticide-free areas who've also had this condition. And in terms of the migratory nature, is moving bees on trucks a little stressful? Well, perhaps it is, but the rate of loss in people who move bees versus those who don't is the same. So that indicates that it's unlikely to be the case. As Diana said, we've been moving bees in this country since 1930. The ancient Egyptians did it up and down the Nile. So bees have been being moved for a very long time. And so the question is, well, why then suddenly 3 years ago have we seen this dramatic increase in mortality? So it doesn't seem likely that moving bees in itself is the underlying stress causing CCD.
All right, lots of questions, and we will return to them right after this break. We're talking about colony collapse disorder, CCD, among bees this hour. As we've been talking about, the phenomenon started about 3 years ago. A lot of work has been done on it since, and we're talking with two of the key people involved in that work, and we'll be taking your questions. If you'd like to join in, we have some open lines for you at 800-642-1234, and you can also email us at and the address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn this morning here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 22 minutes past 9 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm filling in today for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about colony collapse disorder among bees this hour. We've got two guests who have co-written an article, published in the March 31st edition of Scientific American, Solving the Mystery of the Vanishing Bees. Dennis Van Engelsdorp is with us. He is the acting state apiarist with the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and Diana Cox Foster is with us, too. She is the professor of entomology at Pennsylvania State University and the co-director of the Colony Collapse Disorder Team. We've got some calls lined up. We'll be getting to those in just a second. But before we do that, Diana Cox Foster, I'd like to ask you, in terms of making progress on finding some causes behind colony collapse disorder and perhaps finding a way out of all of this, how are we doing progress-wise? Are we making some?
I think we have made significant progress since Dave Hackenberg originally just came forward with his symptoms. We've found that there does appear to be a link between the pathogens and the ultimate collapse or death of the colony. What we don't know at this point in time is what's causing the number of disease organisms to increase greatly. We have a virus that we think may have been introduced recently into the United States that might be part of the problem, along with closely related viruses, but we think that there's got to be additional stresses. And some of those are exposure to pesticides and then also nutritional stress. And so what we've been telling beekeepers that seems to be helping is that they should try to keep their bees as healthy as possible. And that's probably easier to say than to do, but what it means is that they need to keep the mites and other parasites. There's a little single-cell protozoan called Nosema or Microsporidium that gets into bees. Keep those as low as possible, and then also to keep their bees as well-fed as possible. And that may sound strange because you would just think that these bees can just go out and find food anywhere, but it's not the case. Through our activities as humans, we've tried to neaten up our environment some, and that includes like planting lawns and getting rid of all the dandelions and weeds in it, removing weedy areas that we think don't look very good along our roadsides and along the fields. And it turns out a lot of those plants that we've gotten rid of were what the bees were eating, the nectar and the pollen. And so beekeepers sometimes have a hard time finding adequate forage for their bees.
In fact, I think in the article, at one point, somebody said that to a bee flying over a lawn, it's like us being in the middle of a desert. There's just nothing there for them.
That's right. There's absolutely nothing out there for them in a lawn that has no other plants in it besides just the grass itself.
Let's go to callers right now. We've got plenty of them who would like to join in, and David is with us from Waukesha. Hi, David.
Good morning. It's great to be on the air, and I have a couple of questions for the guests. I just finished reading Holly Bishop's book. She's a beekeeper and a writer called Robbing the Bees, because she was on Wisconsin Public Radio last month. And she mentions in there a bunch of things related to this, including hive beetles, Indonesian mites, and fowl brood. And the first question I had is, are those things that have been around for the last 20 years or so connected to what you're talking about also, or do we not know that? And secondarily, are there researchers out there who have been working on or making any breakthroughs about keeping these bees alive, whether they're in huge business-type hives or whether they're any of the 200,000 of us beekeepers that are around the country? And what's the progress there? I want to see that there's some hope, because this sounds like it could be very devastating.
All right. Let's start with Dennis on that one. Dennis?
Well, I think you bring up a couple of really good points. And let me start with the last one. Is there hope? And I think, you know, any silver lining to this picture, it's the fact that when this got into the press, it spiraled, and there was a lot of interest there. And I think that that in itself is encouraging, because I think that innately we all know that a world without bees is not a good thing. And in a very complicated world, we understand that bees dying at these levels can't be good. They could be the canaries in the coal mine. And I think this has generated a lot of interest. We've seen a lot of leadership in the bee industry, in corporations like Häagen-Dazs and Burt's Bees who have given money to this. And so we've seen a lot of different players coming together to think out of the box on how to address some of these underlying issues of diversity. In terms of what beekeepers can do to prevent this, I think Diana just said it. I think that just like us, if we're stressed out, we get the flu. And it's really clear that what these bees are getting is the equivalent of the flu. They have every virus, every pathogen going. They just have these really high levels of pathogens we know and pathogens we don't know. And so that implies that something's gone wrong with their immune system and they're not able to fight off these infections. And so what we need to do is get those bees as stress-free as possible to keep their immune systems as good as possible. And so how do we do that? Well, we make sure we aggressively treat for the known problems. So that includes varroa mite and Noshima. We have to keep them well-fed so they're fat and healthy. You know, we have to make sure that we're treating them right. And I think beekeepers have become much more aggressive about this, and I think we've seen some operations not lose as many bees because they've become much more aggressive about keeping their bees as stress-free as possible.
Has this meant a big change in philosophy for beekeepers, a big change in operations? Do they really, you know, do they have to change everything they do during the course of the day, or do they just have to pay more attention to what they already do?
I think there's a lot more cost, input cost. So, for instance, before, if a colony died, the reason that beekeepers are able to replace numbers so quickly is because if you have one dead colony and one strong colony, you can split your strong colony in half, add a new queen to your dead box equipment, and you have two colonies again. But beekeepers now are being very careful. They're trying to sterilize that equipment before they reuse it, which costs, you know, feeding them aggressively costs. Treating for these diseases costs money. And so I think what we're seeing is that there's a lot more input, so that it's much harder on beekeepers to stay in business because there's so much increased cost.
Let's go back to the phones right now, and Mike is with us from the South Shore. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I had a comment to make. I think this frightful idea that pollination is going to disappear because the honeybees disappear just isn't true. There are wild bees, and actually a lot of the pollination is done by flies and wasps. And so what has to happen, there has to be a change of farming techniques to open up areas. So you have large areas where you have wild plants that produce flowers that flower at different times of the year and stuff to provide pollen and food for wild insects.
And Diana, let's start with you on that. We talked a little bit about changing some of the techniques in lawns and so forth. What about the idea of changing farming techniques as well to address some of these? And secondly, back to Mike's first point, are there other natural pollinators out there who would be able to help out? Do we have to worry about the bees?
So I think he makes a valid point. One thing that was pointed out in one of the side panels in our article and Dennis and I have both started to get involved in this, is that it's not just honeybees that are at risk here, that there's evidence way before CCD ever occurred in the honeybees or that we saw it in 2006, that many of the natural species, the wild pollinators, including flies and other species of bees and the wasps and butterflies and even hummingbirds and bats, that they have been declining. There's many of those species that used to be extremely plentiful, especially in bumblebees, that people aren't finding very often. And there's some concern that some of them have actually gone extinct. So, as Dennis said previously, we're wondering if the honeybee is the canary in the coal mine. We have the honeybee hives. We have their homes, and we know where to find them. And part of the problem with these native species is that their homes are way out in the natural environment, and you can't easily find and locate them. So there are surveys right now to begin to ask what's happening to their populations. And some of the work that Dennis and I have been doing along with many of our other collaborators is that we find that perhaps many of the same stresses and in some cases the diseases themselves may be also potentially affecting these other species. And so the concern is not just the honeybee, but it's all these others. But again, we need to try to maximize these other species. So having the wild areas, unmown areas where the bees can have a nest in the ground, minimizing homeowners' pesticide uses by farmers by having them choose the least toxic amounts, manipulating how they grow the crops in the fields, having fence rows, all those things add up over time.
Now, we've been talking an awful lot about what you think some of the causes might be. Have you made any progress on eliminating causes that aren't part of this picture? I note in the article that some people felt that space aliens might be playing a role in this, and I suspect you may have ruled that out.
Dennis would tackle that one.
I actually don't think we can rule that out, and it's just not a testable hypothesis, so it's possible we can't test for it. It's been an amazing ride in terms of the calls you get with people's suggestions. A lot of people have done seances and have come up with solutions and talked to people in other dimensions, and that's been sort of an interesting sidebar to the whole story. But if I can add to this other question about native bees, I think it's a really important point. There are thousands of species of native bees in this country, and indeed, it is possible that they can pollinate native plants, but they can't do it efficiently. The thing is if we want to produce food in this country like we do now, and maybe we don't, but if we're going to have large acreages of a crop, we need to have a movable pollination force, and honeybees are the only thing where you have 40, 50,000 individuals in a box that you can move in for 2 weeks. And so those native bees are clearly in trouble. There's about 5 species of bumblebees we think have gone extinct, and we need to protect that resource as well. And by protecting them, we're protecting honeybees. And there was a great study out of California which showed that if you have native bees and honeybees together, your fruit set is even better. So I think he makes a good point, but I think that to suggest that we can start producing apples to feed the nation in, people's backyards, would really require a huge dramatic shift in how we produce agriculture.
Let's go back to the phones right now. Mary is with us from La Crosse. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning.
You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I don't like bees. I'm allergic to them. But anyway, I'm wondering, could this have anything to do with the Africanization of bees?
Okay, let me put that question to Dennis. Dennis, could it have anything to do with what Mary calls the Africanization of bees?
No, in a study that's just about to get is right now in review, we examined several of the initial colonies that had CCD. None of them were Africanized. So it's clearly the European bees, Africanized bees, are a concern, but they haven't spread north, and they're certainly not part of any managed bee population. A beekeeper is not going to keep Africanized bees in his yard or in his hives because they wouldn't move. Africanized bees would leave the hive when they're on a truck. So they're not part. Like, bees in boxes are good. They're not Africanized bees.
Okay, and let me just back up for a second here because I think I've missed this very important point. When we're talking about the bees in the boxes, you're referring to European bees. And what kind of bees are those? Where do they come from? And what makes them so good for being transported hither and yon all over the country?
Well, honeybees, what we consider honeybees, were brought over by the colonists when they first came to North America. So before that, there were native bees here, and those are solitary bees. They don't make big colonies. They may, like bumblebees, may have a colony over the summer, but it's only the queen that survives. Honeybees are special in the fact that they have one queen and this large population of sisters, 40, 50,000 in the peak of summer. And so what that allows you to do is you can put them in these boxes and you can move them around on trucks, which is easy to do. They reorient to the place, so they'll find their home again when you put them on the ground. And they're very efficient pollinators because they're very faithful. When they start visiting one crop, they stay on that crop for that visit, so they're able to pollinate really well. So honeybees are just sort of the perfect pollinators, and they're easy to manage, and they're easy to move. And so when we're talking about European honeybees, those are the introduced species, versus the thousands of native bees we have here. But those are tiny, and they can be metallic green. I mean, they're beautiful things, but they're not easily managed.
Now, Diana Cox Foster, we've been talking an awful lot about what's happening here in the United States. Are there similar things happening in other parts of the world?
So we think that there are likely to be similar things happening elsewhere. There are many different reports in the media that there are massive die-offs of bees in other countries, and some of them fairly severe. And some researchers there are beginning to say that some of the symptoms do match CCCD. Some of the other symptoms are probably more like what we had seen prior to 2004-2006. But there is concern worldwide about the decline in overall pollinators and especially honeybees.
Now, if you saw something that was worldwide and that was connected to CCD, is that a worse scenario than if it's just sort of relegated to the U.S.? I mean, I'm imagining that it would be, but I don't know if I'm right on that.
It is a worst-case scenario because if we look at food production, pollination overall is linked into getting that other third of bite of food that we need every day. And so there have been some recent studies been done on looking at the economics of pollination and our dependence on honeybees and other pollinators and saying, well, it won't be a complete catastrophe if it all disappears, but indeed it will have a major impact on our human population. The big concern is that in the next few years, we're expected to have increased population growth in many parts of the world. And there, what the role of pollination means and what bees are needed for may be even more important. There's an example from China in a valley that lost honeybees for some reason. It was suspected to be pesticides, but there's no bees available in this valley. It has extremely steep slopes in the valley that are planted with fruit trees, both apples and pears. And as early as 2000, it was noted that the only way for those farmers to get production of fruit was to do hand pollination. And that means that they have to go out and collect the flowers, dry the pollen off the little anthers that are in the flower, grind it up with a mortar and pestle, and then they take feather dusters and climb into the trees. These are full-size fruit trees, and hand-pollinate the flowers that they want to produce the fruit. It's hard to see how something like that could be done here in the U.S., but I think that's the one image that I saw. There's a PBS special that's available online that people can go back and look at. It's called The Silence of Bees. That depicts this, and that, to me, was just completely terrifying.
And that was called The Silence of Bees?
Right.
All right. And that's a PBS special if anybody wants to look that up online. We're talking about colony collapse disorder among bees this hour with our guests. And, well, we'll be taking your calls, too. We have a lot of them to get to. 800-642-1234 is our number if you'd like to join in. And if the lines are busy, you can also join us on email. And that address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today filling in for Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 10 o'clock this morning, I'll be talking with a guest, and we'll be taking a look at what's happening in cyberspace in terms of people breaking into big systems and possibly disrupting our electrical grid. That's coming up after 10 o'clock this morning. Right now, this hour, we're talking about colony collapse disorder among bees. And we have two guests with us, Diana Cox Foster, a professor of entomology at Pennsylvania State University, and the co-director of the Colony Collapse Disorder Team, Dennis Fang Engelsdorp, is also a member of that team. And together, the two wrote an article, Solving the Mystery of the Vanishing Bees, that was published in the March 31st edition of Scientific American. Let's go back to the phones right now, and this time we're going to go to Rand, who is with us from Spitzer. Hi, Rand.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Diane, Dennis, and Dean, I've listened to it. I'm a biologist, and I also used to raise bees. And I actually had an empty hive that I kind of half retired and just moved twice. And I had, believe it or not, honeybee swarms move into this hive. And from what you said this morning, I've got two things I'm wondering if you are looking at or might have some involvement in this. Bees that swarm, of course, would go out into nature, probably interact with other native bees. I wonder if this would have anything to do with it. And then tied to that, knowing that we've got fewer and fewer honeybee people in the United States, I should say with bigger farms and everything else, is there a chance that there's some genetic inbreeding that might affect the immune system? Those are my two ideas or concerns. Could you please expound on that?
And Dennis Van Engelstorp, let's start with you on that.
Well, I think that the first thing I'd like to say is, you know, that actually there aren't fewer beekeepers in the country. There are a lot more. It's just that most beekeepers are small-scale beekeepers that have bees in their backyard. And I would encourage everyone to do it. I mean, it's the most relaxing, enjoyable thing you can do. I mean, you have to be in that zen. You have to be calm. I mean, it's just fascinating. Sisters working together on those beautiful days. And so I encourage everyone to try it at least once and then become a beekeeper. In terms of is there, you know, when bees swarm, swarming arguably is a way that bees control parasite and disease loads naturally. And also when they swarm, they find homes in trees that are distant from other colonies, and so it's less likely disease is going to spread that way. However, if you're a beekeeper, what you're trying to do is manage your population of bees, and you don't want your colonies to swarm because that's your honey supply or your honey production flying away from your hive. And so swarming isn't a good idea that way. I think one of your questions is could the presence of these bees and their diseases being effective affecting native populations of bees? And I think I'll let Diana talk to that because she's been working on that a little bit more than I have. And in terms of is there a problem with inbreeding, bees are unique in the fact that they've got this natural inability to inbreed. If a colony, if a queen mates with someone who, or a drone that's too related, the colony won't survive. And so they've got this. However, is there a reduction in the diversity of bees? Absolutely. There's some really good work coming out of Washington to show that. And in order to address that, there have been very regulated imports of other populations of bees from Europe and Russia that have also sort of been brought in order to help develop resistant lines that don't need, that can fight some of these diseases naturally. It's interesting, the White House is getting some hives, and they're actually going to get Russian queens in those hives because they're better at fighting disease.
And what does it tell you when the White House is getting hives? Do you think that's going to help put a bit more of a media spotlight on the work of bees?
Well, I think it's important. I think that what they're doing is they're saying that, you know, garden and food production is a web of different components, and bees play a very important part in that component.
We have an email from John in Stoughton. Has anyone looked at a possible relationship between the problems with bees and the problems with bats? He says the collapse of both groups appear to have started at about the same time. And Diana, let's hear from you on that.
So we have been asking that same question, if there's any linkage there. So one of the things that I was very much involved in was asking about diseases that were involved in CCD. And we linked up with a group in Columbia University, Ian Lipkin's group, and he's one of these germ hunters who primarily focuses on diseases coming into humans and other vertebrate animal populations. And he's actually done a look at both the honeybees and at the bats, and what we can say is that we don't see any common diseases that we've yet found in both of them. What we are concerned with is that maybe some of these same stresses that we think are affecting bees and causing their immune systems to be weakened might be ongoing in the bats as well. And so I know that Dennis and Jeff Pettis have directly talked with many of the groups looking at the bat population decline to share with them about how we went about to try to do surveys on bees and to begin to dissect the problem. And so we do have that ongoing discussion happening right now.
And, you know, as I hear all these questions being raised and as I hear you and Dennis answering all of them, it is really amazing when you start to think about it. And I guess it's just common sense, but everything is so interconnected that you really, at this point, can't rule anything out, can you?
No, you can't. And I think it points to a lack of awareness that we as humans have had about how interconnected things are, that all our ecosystems around us, not just our food production, but the natural world around us, that everything is connected to each other. So anything that we put out into the environment is going to have an impact of some sort, and each and every organism that's there has a special role to play. So trying to learn more and protect it is important.
Let's go back to the phones, and Nancy is with us from Kewaunee. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, good morning. I'm really excited about this program. There's a few things I'd like to address, and one of them is, or both of them actually, concern farm practices. And I live in a rural community here in Kewaunee, and one thing that I notice that alarms me where I live is that hedgerows are being ripped out and tree lines and whatnot that I think are a very important part of our ecosystem that need to remain. And I think some of the newer farmers are negligent in realizing that those tree lines had a very important role. And one of the roles would have been these insects and the role they play in our environment. That's my first thing I want to address. And the second is the idea of genetic crops. And I think some of my information came from the PBS special you talk about, The Silence of Bees. I'm not sure, but I did see this on TV. And what it said was that these genetic crops, like your corn crops that are genetically modified, leave the bees after they feed on the pollen disoriented, and that they cannot find their way back to the hive. And then the second part of that they were finding all these dead bees, and they were actually doing these bee autopsies, and that they were not digesting this pollen. So if you could answer those three questions, I'd really appreciate it. Thank you.
Nancy, thanks for the call. And I think we'll start with Dennis on this. Anything on the genetic crops that Mary was talking about?
Well, I think that there are a couple of issues there. I think that genetically modified crops are those crops that have had a gene inserted to produce sort of a BT. BT is the common one, and that's a protein. And before CCD happened, there was some concern that BT pollen would be bad for bees, but every feeding study done with BT pollen showed that there was no measurable effect on bee health. So we don't think BT, genetically modified crops, are involved. The disorientation thing, I think, is because that there are these new pesticides, this new group of pesticides, which are applied on very small amounts to the seed and then get sucked up by the plant and can be in there. And there is some concern that this may be disorienting to the bees. We have found no evidence that this pesticide is playing a role in CCD. However, that was in our initial screening, and there's reason to pursue that a little bit more aggressively, and certainly that's going on. In terms of hedgerows, I think that one of the things that is sort of good about this situation is that everyone can play a role in bee recovery. And so I think the idea of why do we plant lawns and not meadows, I think everyone should get a pollinator garden. I think we need to change our aesthetic about what is beautiful. Certainly there is, it's important that farmers play a role in keeping hedgerows, but I think that everyone who has a piece of earth can play a role in this recovery, and I think that that's the only way this is going to happen. There's a big movement in France trying to get 10% of all land into sort of some natural system, and that involves a lot of people's backyards. And so I think that that's an encouraging part. And the third question was autopsies. Autopsies is something that my lab's been doing a lot of. We're finding an awful lot of things we don't understand. We're working with Diana trying to figure out what some of these things are. Certainly in some cases, especially early on, we were finding that it didn't seem like the pollen was getting digested. But we found all sorts of very strange anomalies, and we think we found some new potential new pathogens in bees. But that's, again, an indication that the immune system in these bees has probably collapsed.
If I could add into what Dennis just said, one of the things that we found in our survey of all the organisms that were in bees is that their bees probably are like us, that they have bacteria that live in their digestive tract that are probably essential to their digestion of their food and utilization of it. And you could sort of think of this like, is it critical that we try to maintain healthy digestive system bees? Can we give them things like probiotics, per se, that might help them out? And so one of the questions that some other groups are asking is, what are the impacts on these bacteria and the digestive processes in these bees that are dying? Is there some other stress that's causing that to fail? So that's one of the things that we've been looking at.
Lots to think about. Let's go back to the phones. And Lynn is with us from Winneconnie. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, good morning. And I think Dennis kind of addressed what I had asked to bring up again and revisit is the idea of lawns, that America has been so marketed on the idea of the smooth monoculture green lawn. I don't think people have any idea how to get started. Maybe a little corner, maybe a this or whatever, the gardens, you had mentioned that. But I wonder if you could guide them to any kind of resources so they don't kind of look at the people who have more natural areas and think that it's something evil or neglected, that this is the way we should probably be heading. And I know you addressed it, and I'll take your answers off the air. Thank you.
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for the call. And Dennis, she does bring up a good point, because every so often, at least in Wisconsin, when somebody, you know, has their lawn sort of go native, so to speak, the neighbors get upset. And, I'll read a newspaper article occasionally about somebody who's had their lawn turned back into a prairie, and there's a lot of unhappiness around that.
Yeah, we have a saying for that. Is it's sort of like keeping a beard, just trim the edges. So as long as you mow the outside of it, and then you can say it's a manicured garden. So maybe that's a way of getting around it. I think, though, where do you find resources about what to plant? I think that there are two organizations that have done a really good job trying to get the word out and get things, and that's pollinator.org, which is the National Coalition for Pollinators, and also the Xerce Society, and you can go find their website, too, and they're dedicated to preserving invertebrates, and they're at sort of the leading front of trying to figure out how to provide habitat for native bees. And so I think those are two places you can go to get information about how to convert.
So pollinator.org and the Xerce Society, how do you spell that?
That is X-E-R-C-E-S.
X-E-R-C-E-S. All right, very good.
If I could add another resource that people would begin to see here, and part of the money that we received from Haagen-Dazs to promote bee health went to the Master Gardener program here in Pennsylvania, and they've developed some really nice programs now on how to teach people how to grow pollinator gardens. And so I think they've now gotten it underway, and we expect that that will begin to blossom and spread to other states as well. So these will be gardeners who can go out to teach other gardeners how to do this and do it well in a way that people would consider it to be very attractive, and it will benefit the bees. There's a few other bees that people can encourage, too, that they're very gentle bees. There's mason bees. You can actually go online now in many different companies to buy little houses that would encourage the bees to come in. The houses look sort of like a bunch of straws put together. And these bees are very good pollinators as well. So there are many other ways that people can encourage the bees come to the yards besides bringing in a colony of honeybees.
Now, in the last couple of years that you've been working on this, and you sort of alluded to it earlier in the hour when we talked about all the media attention that this story got in the beginning, but as the story has continued over the last couple of years, have you seen that interest continuing, or like so many things, that does it peak for a while and then just go away? I mean, where do you see the level of interest now? I mean, we've been getting an awful lot of questions here.
I think that there's still a lot of interest in this. Of course, with the election and the economy, the interest has been focused on the other areas. But we are beginning to still see media requests coming in to Penn State and even media requests from other countries. I've had emails just today come in from Japan to ask about what my opinions were. So it's something I think people are still focused on. And it's a good thing. Originally, way back when we our first media interview, we were brand new at it. And we thought it was probably just the one and only media interview that we would ever have. Little did we know But at the end of the interview, there came over the blackberries of the media people that the death of a prominent socialite had occurred, and we thought, well, that's it, that this will just replace the bees. But we've outlived that particular story, so hopefully this will continue to be of concern to people, because this is a major problem that will affect us and our children from here on out.
Well, I'd like to thank both of you for taking the time to be with us today and bringing us up to speed on what's happening with colony collapse disorder. So thanks to Diana Cox Foster, professor of entomology at Pennsylvania State University and the co-director of the Colony Collapse Disorder Team, and also thanks to Dennis Van Engelsdorp, the acting state apiarist for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Together, they co-wrote an article, you'll find it in the March 31st edition of Scientific American, Solving the Mystery of the Vanishing Bees, and we've been talking about that for the past hour. If you'd like a copy of the program, you can look online at WPR.org and check out our archives. Rhonda Fanning produced the program and provided us with on-air production as well. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.